This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Newt implodes but goes off to debate. Bachman steals headlines with a declaration. T-Paw picks a fight with Mitt, then backs down. It's Wednesday, and time for an Obamacare edition of the Political Junkie.
There you go again.
I hear your new ideas, I'm reminded of that ad. Where's the beef?
Extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice.
Senator, you're no Jack Kennedy.
You don't have Nixon to kick around anymore.
Lipstick.
But I'm the decider.
Every Wednesday, political junkie Ken Rudin joins us to recap the week in politics. John Huntsman, who skipped Monday's debate in Manchester, jumps in next Tuesday. We await decisions from Palin and Perry. The seven GOP candidates who did take the stage saved their punches for the president, who in the meantime politicked in Puerto Rico. Washington Governor Christine Gregoire will not seek re-election while Assistant VA Secretary Tammy Duckworth resigned, maybe to make another run for Congress in Illinois. And newly released photos show a smiling Gabby Giffords. In a few moments, we'll speak with Donna Brazile about how to prep a candidate for a debate. Do you come out swinging or just smile and dodge the question? Later in the program, Hillary Clinton's blunt remarks on Libya get a chilly response in Johannesburg. But first, political junkie Ken Rudin joins us, as usual, here in Studio 3A. And as usual, we begin with a trivia question. Hey, Ken.
Hi, Neil. Okay, well, you mentioned Christine Gregoire, who is not going to run for a third term in Washington State. The governorship in that state has been under one-party control for a long time, but it's only number two as far as streaks go. So the question is, what state governorship has currently been controlled by one party the longest?
If you think you know the answer to this week's trivia question, which state governorship has currently been controlled by one party the longest, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. And, of course, the winner gets a fabulous no-prize T-shirt. And, Ken, well, one thing that all the candidates could agree on, those who were on the stage in Manchester, New Hampshire, at St. Anselm's on Monday night, they could agree on the flaws of the President of the United States.
The Obama administration is an anti-jobs, anti-business, anti-American energy, destructive force.
He has failed in job one, which was to get this economy going again. He failed in job two, which is to restrain the growth of government. And he failed in job three, which is to have a coherent, consistent foreign policy.
Just make no mistake about it. I want to announce tonight, President Obama is a one-term president.
This economy is stalled. It's like a train on the tracks with no engine. And the administration has simply been putting all of this money in the caboose.
This president is a declinist. He views America as one of equals around the world. We're not the same as Portugal. We're not the same as Argentina.
And Ken, that was about all the ammunition they fired in one particular direction. They declined pretty much. Well, it's the 11th commandment, is it? Thou not shalt speak ill of another republic.
Well, that's what a lot of people were criticizing the other Republicans for. They said that Mitt Romney is vulnerable and to take him down a notch, here's a great opportunity to do it. And you could have done it at the debate. As you point out, that Tim Pawlenty mentioned Obamacare, combining Obama and Romney in the same breath on Fox News, but failing to repeat that during the debate. But, you know, this is still early. A lot of people are still getting to introduce, to meet these candidates for the first time. Michelle Bachman actually announced her candidacy on the debate, which was pretty remarkable.
And guaranteed her a spot in at least the second sentence of everybody's story.
That's exactly right. And I think she did far better than anybody expected. I think she was personable and charming and you know, all that stuff. And a lot of people did so well, and kind of well, like Herman Cain, I thought, won the Juan Williams primary by going after Muslims. I thought that was a very encouraging thing. But here's the thing, though. Remember, if you go back to 2007, 2008, in the beginning, Hillary Clinton was the clear front runner on the Democratic side. A lot of Democrats stayed away. No pot shots at Bill Clinton or the Clintons themselves. And then it wasn't until like September, I believe it was, I think September or November, Tim Russert asked Hillary a question about a driver license for illegals, and then people started to say, wait a second, Hillary's no longer the front runner. In other words, the opportunities that the Republicans had to take down Mitt Romney from whatever perch he's on right now, I don't think it was a tremendously lost opportunity when they didn't do it on one day.
And we're going to talk more about debate tactics a little bit later in the program with Donna Brazile from the other party. But the tactics are pretty much the same early in the race. Do you take out the opposition? And anyway, we'll get back to that. But there's some news about some of the other people. Newt Gingrich, who was on stage as one of the candidates, lost his entire campaign organization last
week. He did. I think the only person who stayed was Callista, his wife, I think, and she was debating whether to resign. No, look, Newt Gingrich and his campaign staff and of consultants are clearly had a different philosophical approach to running for president. They feel that the way to do it is, well, to campaign in Iowa, for example, and Newt Gingrich had no schedule at all.
He's apparently campaigning in Greece.
Well, exactly right. He and his wife took a two-week cruise, which was long scheduled, but they feel you got to knock on doors, and I think the feeling is Newt Gingrich feels that it's ideas that wins the nomination, it's ideas that gets votes, not the nitty-gritty that you need to do to win votes, and that there was a big split, so he lost his campaign manager, his top consultants, his top people in Iowa and South Carolina, his press secretary who's been with him forever, but Newt Gingrich insists he'll continue.
And then we had the news that Mitt Romney, the presumed front runner, is going to concentrate on New Hampshire, apparently, because he's going to skip the Iowa straw poll.
Well, he's not going to skip the Iowa caucuses, but as he remember, 4 years ago, he spent over $1 million to run in the Iowa straw poll, which is seemingly a meaningless event. It's every August in the year before the presidential election. Mitt Romney won it in 2007, but of course he finished second in the caucuses. So he felt like, you know, maybe it's more of a show. But actually, a lot of people in Iowa especially take the straw poll very seriously. Last time, Tommy Thompson dropped out of the race the day after the Iowa straw poll. Lamar Alexander dropped out of the race 2 days after the Iowa straw poll. A lot of people give a tremendous significance to this event. Mitt Romney says, look, straw polls are just that. I'm going to worry more about where the actual votes are in the caucuses and the primaries.
Meantime, some of those top Gingrich aides who resigned were previously associated with Rick Perry, the governor of Texas, who may or may not be considering a run for president this time. He may have a campaign staff ready to go if he does. And we also heard news about Sarah Palin, the former governor of Alaska, when the state released zillions of emails from her days in office, including her time as the running mate of John McCain for the Republican vice presidential candidate. And people looking for a smoking gun, well, all they found was a gap.
Well, you know, all these, I mean, for example, look, there were 24,000 pages of emails. Now, 8,000 pages, I should say, were either withheld or redacted. So we don't know everything that came out here. But for all the stuff, everybody's out to find out all this, you know, this salacious stuff about Sarah Palin. Did it show her to be petty? Did it show her to be generous? I mean, it showed her not unusual. It just seemed like a big let's embarrass Sarah Palin. And ultimately, I didn't see there didn't seem to be much there.
She came across as a pretty engaged governor. Yes, a little sensitive to the press. Boy, she's the first governor ever to feel that way.
Well, exactly. And as a matter of fact, a lot of the mood you saw with her, trusting and paranoid and accepting and feeling betrayed, I'm sure you feel that. You see that with almost every politician, let alone somebody who, look, back then, she was a very, very popular governor who took on her own party, and that's what brought her to power in the first place.
Meantime, we have some people on the line who think they know the answer to this week's trivia question. Again, the governorship that has been in the hands of one party for the longest, the current governorship in the hands of one party the longest, 800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org. We'll start with Jerry. Jerry with us from Mitchell in South Dakota. Jerry?
Yes.
You're on the air, Jerry.
Yes, my guess is Alabama.
Alabama.
Well, the Alabama does have a Republican governor, but as recently as 1998, Democrat Don Siegelman was elected there, so it's not Alabama.
Nice try, Jerry. Thanks very much for the call. Let's see if we go next. This is Tucker. Tucker with us from Salt Lake.
It's got to be Utah.
Well, Utah is pretty close. I mean, of course, it's a big Republican bastion, and we had John Huntsman there pretty recently. But 1980, Scott Matheson was elected governor.
Scott Matheson.
That was Jerry Mathis.
Jerry Mathis.
So
yes, okay.
But anyway, it's close, but not Utah.
Thank you, Tucker.
Maybe next time.
Okay. Let's see if we go next to this is Justin. Justin with us from Charleston.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air, Justin.
South Carolina.
No, that's pretty recent. You
first to secede, but not the
right. You have Nikki Haley now. You had Mark Sanford when he was elected governor of the Appalachians, but
Appalachian Trail. Yeah.
Exactly right. In 1998, you had Jim Hodges, who was a Democrat. So that's pretty recent for the Democrats.
Thanks very much, Justin. Let's see if we go next to this is Sam, and Sam's with us from Chapel Hill.
Hi. I just drove across it, and it was the most conservative state I had been in, so I'm going to say South Dakota.
South Dakota is the correct answer.
Ding, ding, ding. Congratulations.
In 1974, as you all remember, Richard Kniep was elected governor as a Democrat. He was reelected in 74. There has not been a Democrat.
Wasn't that Mac the Kniep?
Cano. But you're thinking of Laura Canoy.
That's it.
Is what you are. But anyway, Richard Kniep in 1974, no Democrat has been elected in South Dakota for governor since.
Again, Sam, congratulations. Hang on the line. We'll collect your particulars and send you a Political Junkie No Prize t-shirt in exchange for your promise to send us a digital picture of yourself to post on our wall of shame.
He could Twitter it if he wants.
Okay, Sam.
All right, thank you.
All right, let's put him on hold, and I even hit the right button. In the meantime, as we mentioned, the source of all this, Christine Gregoire announcing she will not run for a third term in the state of Washington.
Yeah, she's had a tough time. When she was elected governor 8 years ago for the first time, she won it over Dino Rossi by about 168, 180 votes, something like that, the closest race of the country. She, a Democrat, the good news for the Democratic Party is she's not going to run again. She's taken a lot of heat for a lot of budget problems, as a lot of governors have. And Jay Inslee, the congressman there, is likely to run for the seat. The Republicans will be Rob McKenna, who's the state attorney general. Republicans haven't won that race of governorship since 1980.
And also there is Tammy Duckworth, the deputy head of the VA, a wounded combat vet who may be running for Congress in her home state of Illinois.
Right. She ran in 2006. She had lost both legs in a helicopter. Her helicopter was shot down over Iraq. Ran for Congress 2006, with all these new Democratic seats opening up because of redistricting, it looks like Tammy Duckworth is going to run for Congress once again in Illinois.
And in the meantime, good to see pictures of Gabby Giffords smiling and looking happy, and of course that after the terrible shooting in Tucson earlier this year. In the meantime, Ken Rudin, NPR's political editor and our political junkie, joins us every Wednesday afternoon. More with him in a moment. Donna Brazile will join us to talk about preparation and tactics for the big debates and how do you exploit your candidate's appearance on such an event. I'm Neil Conan. Stay with us. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
To be a politician and take over this beautiful land. And take over this beautiful land. And take over this beautiful land.
This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. It's Political Junkie Day. Ken Rudin is here as usual. You can read his blog, download his podcast, and take a shot at that devilish scuttle button puzzle all at npr.org/junkie. Ken's show prep usually involves some time with his button collection and a lot of hairspray. The candidates for the presidential nomination usually do a bit more to prepare for their debates. On Monday in New Hampshire, Republican hopefuls played relatively nice, saving their sharpest attacks for the president. Campaign managers are certainly advising their candidates to smile. Don't be too specific. Just introduce yourself to the country. This early in the primary season, don't worry about taking swipes at the rivals in your own party. There are several more months for that. The top GOP strategists are generally tied up right now with one campaign or another. In a moment, Democratic strategist Donna Brazile will join us to talk about how candidates prepare for debates. If you've been moved by a debate moment, reconsidered a candidate, or decided to make a donation to a candidate, give us a call by something you heard in a debate. 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. And you can join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. Joining us here in Studio 3A is Donna Brazile, Democratic strategist, served as campaign manager for Al Gore's presidential run in 2000. Nice to have you back on the program.
It's good to be back, and it's good to see Ken as usual.
when you're going into a debate this early in the primary season, do you actually go out and have mock preparations? You have people portraying the other candidates and, testing questions and responses?
Oh, absolutely. Look, this is a very big moment for any campaign. It's an opportunity to introduce yourself, an opportunity to start testing, test driving your message, an opportunity to really begin to build the kind of political support, organization, donor network that you will need to survive the primary. So this was a very key moment for a number of Republicans, and for obvious reasons. They're still in the phase of the campaign where voters really cannot recognize them, don't know their names. And so they use the opportunity to say, hello. I noticed John Cain gave him an opportunity to say, I'm Rick Santorum. I served in Congress. My wife and I have X number of kids. So this is an opportunity for them to really tell their story and to get their message out to Republican voters.
And a little early to start differentiating yourself from the other rivals in your own party.
Well, you know, debates are about competition. And so clearly the message for the Republican candidates at this moment is to define yourself and to contrast your vision with the president of the United States, Barack Obama. So Mitt Romney, who is the presumed frontrunner by virtue of his numbers in the polls, clearly he walked into that debate thinking about the general election. He introduced himself and then he totally focused his message on the economy against President Obama. The other candidates clearly joined in and decided not to go after Mitt Romney.
Ken?
Donna, the question is it a mistake? Most of the post-debate analysis was that Tim Pawlenty, all these guys had an opportunity to rough up the front runner. But as you say, a lot of the voters out there don't know who Tim Pawlenty is, and to go negative, a first impression might not be the right way to go.
Well, you know, I think Tim Pawlenty will have plenty of opportunities to contrast his vision of the future, his economic proposal with Mitt Romney and the others. Right now, I believe his advisors clearly said, hey, go in there, introduce yourself to the people. Remember, most of us don't know Tim Pawlenty. We don't know that he was governor of Minnesota, and we don't know about his economic record. So he didn't want to go in there and start beating up on Mitt Romney when he had an opportunity to, you know, advance his own name ID as well as his own economic proposals.
You only get a chance to announce once. You're almost guaranteed a headline when you do. I thought Michelle Bachmann played it pretty smart.
I thought she was, first of all, she was poised. She was relaxed. She really connected. She used her moment well to get out her message. Look, I don't have to agree with these candidates to understand that what they're trying to do right now is to position themselves as the alternative to Mitt Romney, but also position themselves in the case of Michelle Bachmann, who's probably looking over her shoulder at some of the other candidates who are thinking about jumping into the race.
Sarah Palin. She's trying
to position herself as the Tea Party most conservative candidate out there.
You know, Don, I was thinking of the first time I can remember a woman in a debate, and that was George H.W. Bush and Geraldine Ferraro, that vice presidential debate in 1984, where it seemed like he didn't know how to deal with a woman, whereas it seemed like Michelle Bachmann seemed like one of the guys. Almost.
Well, you know, I think we've learned a lot since 2008 when we saw Hillary Clinton compete for the Democratic nomination. And by the way, and I've said this before, but I thought she won practically all of the debates because she knew the issues, she had a strong and compelling message, and yet she was able to play offense and not defense. Michelle Bachmann went in there on Monday night, and first of all, she looked directly in the camera. So you know, Ed Rollins, my colleague from CNN, who's now an advisor to Michelle Bachmann, he probably said, whatever you do, look
at
into the
camera.
Because she was on message, focus on trying to introduce herself to voters. And at the same time, she looked quite naturally part of the Gang of Seven, not an outsider. And most, as you know, historically speaking, women candidates have often been seen as outsiders.
We know you're not with a candidate right now. We can tell that because your fingernails are all looking pretty good.
Yeah.
What does a campaign manager do while that show is on the air, while the debate's on the air? Are you just sitting there eating your liver?
Oh, absolutely not. First of all, it's a nerve-wracking moment because you're watching your candidate. First of all, you want to make sure that he or she is actually looking the part. They're prepared, that they are comfortable, that they are relaxed, not stiff or boring. I noticed that Newt Gingrich at first appeared to be totally out of place. He looked as though he wanted to be somewhere else, perhaps shopping at Tiffany's on a cruise.
Careful.
No, I'm just saying some of his past activities. But clearly, if you Tim Pawlenty seemed very relaxed. So you want to look at your candidate. You want to hear what he or she is saying. But more importantly, you want to take advantage of any mistakes or gaffes from the other side, because the moment the debate is over, you want to rush into the room where the media is all on stakeout and say, hey, guess what? My guy or my gal, here's what he did. Here's what she said. But guess what? This other guy, he lost it. He's a loser. And so as you notice, after the debate, the media came around and said we had two losers. Mr. Pawlenty, because he acted like a number two and not a number one, and Mr. Kane. I thought Mr. Kane simply... Now, I thought Mr. Kane was refreshing, but some of my colleagues thought that perhaps he was a little bit too pious, and he seemed like a fringe candidate, not somebody who was ready for mainstream national attention.
Well, you're not only trying to prepare your lines for the spin room after the show. You usually have a surrogate who goes out there, somebody who's...
You line up people who know the candidate, who can go out there and talk about the candidate in a very human way, whether it's a fellow governor, a colleague, a family member. But you line up your surrogates, you get all your key strategists, your consultants as well to go out there. But remember, we're also dealing in a world of Twitter and Facebook, and your opposition research staffers are busy putting together what I call the white paper, to get out there to the media, who might not have an opportunity to Google all of the mistakes that were made, all of the highlights, and you're also rushing that piece of paper out to the media as well.
But, you're talking about mistakes and gaffes, and there are mistakes of fact, but there's also, remember, the Al Gore sigh of 2000 or the George H.W. Bush looking at his watch in 1992. I mean, those weren't seen as gaffes, and yet those stand out in my mind as big mistakes made by folks in debates.
Again, that's why I was looking at body language. I was looking at the candidates, how they interacted with each other. When Romney was speaking, I kept trying to look at Mr. Pawlenty's face. When Ron Paul was talking, I noticed that many of the other candidates just sat there rolling their eyes. And so, yeah, it's entertaining, but it's also for campaigns. It's a very important moment in terms of getting your message out, becoming better known to voters across the country, and really using this opportunity to go out there and raise some money.
They keep saying that size don't matter, but with Al Gore, those size did matter in 2000.
Oh, they mattered a great deal for obvious reasons. I mean, you have we now have HDTV, so in addition to hearing the sigh and looking at facial expressions, as you well know, we can also capture a wrinkle or any other facial expression now with all of this new technology.
Our guest is Donna Brazile, a Democratic political strategist, and we want to hear about debate moments you've watched that changed your opinion of a candidate. Maybe got you to consider making a donation. 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. Scott's on the line from Tillamook in Oregon.
Yeah, hello.
Hi.
Well, I was just talking to somebody about 2000 when I was voting for the first time in a presidential election, and it was the only vulnerable moment of a life growing up raised by strong Democrats. And the rolling of the eyes and the irritability progressing throughout the debate caused me to make what I consider the biggest mistake politically of my life for George W.
And so you voted on the basis of what you thought was impatient behavior by the then vice president.
Yes. Yeah. I watched Al Gore and I thought, man, I appreciate his policy, but I don't want to. At the time, I didn't want to vote for somebody who seemed like he could make flippant decisions and be so irritable.
Donna Brazile, you were watching that debate, I'm sure, pretty carefully. What were you thinking when you saw that?
Well, honestly, I have to tell you the truth. I was in the holding room prior to the debate, and I noticed that the Vice President, Al Gore, at the time, was drinking one too many Diet Cokes, and then followed up by one of those power bars. And I'm like, uh-oh, he's going to have a surge moment. And after his makeup was applied. And of course, you need makeup when you're on TV to hide spots and to make sure that you don't come across like you've been sweating all day. And I said, "Oh my God!" And I looked at Tipper and I said, "I think he has too much makeup on, too much rouge or something." And you know, I'm not the expert on makeup, but she said, "No, leave it alone," because it was dark in the holding room. The moment he got out on stage, I wanted to run out with a handkerchief and just say, "Oh my God, get that off!" I get a tissue and get it off his face. But in terms of, you know, yes, when we saw Al Gore sigh when he looked uncomfortable, I kept thinking, I said, "I hope nobody is paying attention, because maybe." Yeah, you know, with two Diet Cokes, maybe he needs to go to the men's room. And then when I heard the sigh, I'm like, "Ooh, that's the surge." So it was a mistake, but I'm a person that typically focus on the what I call the substance. But after that debate, I started focusing on the style in terms of body language, holding your own, looking the part, and not moving when you're behind that podium.
All right. Scott, thanks very much for the phone call.
Sorry, thank Scott.
Again, it's Donna Brazil. She's with us here in Studio 3A, along with political junkie Ken Rudin, who's with us every Wednesday. And again, the website is npr.org/junkie for the scuttle button puzzle and the podcast and the blog. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's see if we can go next to McGregor. McGregor with us from Philadelphia. McGregor, hi.
Hi there. I'll never forget when I watched President Clinton debate, before he became president, then President Bush, in the moment when at the first town hall meeting, Bill Clinton stepped forward to talk to the people, and I think President Bush looked at his watch, and I said to him, I called my friend, and I said, "I just watched a man become president."
There may have been a few other factors. Ross Perot, I think, had an influence in that race, too. But Donna Brazil, there is a huge moment when your candidate is up against the rival, the other candidate, on stage for the first time.
You want to look presidential. It's important to come across as being relaxed, poised, professional, just staying in your lane, stand behind that podium, standing straight up. That's a very important moment. The American people, remember, this is an interview, and they're watching you. They're watching your body language. They're watching everything.
Thanks very much, McGregor. You mentioned something earlier, and this is you have those talking points for the spin people afterwards. But are those the same talking points you're going to be using to call up donors the next day?
Well, look, if it's a primary campaign and you're still trying to knock off the quote unquote competition before you get into the real game, the general election, yeah, you want to call up some undecided donors, like you're calling up undecided voters, and you want to remind them that your candidate did very well, and maybe there's an opportunity for you to jump on board. The water is warm, come on over. And then if you want to follow up with the candidate, look, as you well know, presidential politics is notorious for you have to raise a substantial amount of money. And debate opportunities, it's an opportunity. Debate moments, it's an opportunity to raise money, to raise your profile, and also to begin to build your organization.
After you've come out of a debate and you analyze how well or poorly you have done, do your tactics, you have to adjust your tactics, don't you?
Oh, no question. First of all, you got to worry about the next debate. You have to, you want to bounce because you're looking for some sign in the polls that you've done well. And so the next day you want to go out and have a rally. You want to, you know, get what I call the yes crowd together so that they can say, yes, you won the debate. And you really, you know, you want to start focusing on the next big event on the calendar.
Ken?
I was thinking that, you know, in 1960, of course, Nixon, Kennedy, those debates obviously helped John F. Kennedy, showed him to be as equal as the vice president. But I'm thinking more of 1980 right now. Ronald Reagan, seen as a right-wing extremist, yet when he stood up there with Jimmy Carter, he was an aw shucks kind of guy who basically won over the American people.
Well, as you know, that many of us in politics spend a lot of time trying to define our opponent. You want to define the person before they won. before they have an opportunity to define themselves. And so back in, I wasn't in the 80 campaign. I worked at the grassroots level, but at the in 84, in that Mondale moment, Ronald Reagan just, he was relaxed. Remember, he was a professional actor, so he didn't come across as this extremist that we Democrats tried to paint him as, somebody who was out of the mainstream, somebody who was so far to the right that he would take the country off on a cliff, somebody who was unprepared. And yet he came to the debate looking like somebody who could actually handle the pressure of the job. We kept talking about the nuclear button and, you know, do you trust this guy? And he came across as like a grandfather figure, somebody you could trust.
And obviously, policy plays a huge role in your decision about who to work for. Of course, if they offer you a job, that's important, too. But how well they perform, how much is that a factor?
I think that's a huge factor because, look, at the end of the day, it's not just a job interview that the American people is conducting. It's also this is somebody you have to live with for 4 years, like them or not. I mean, I've lived with Republican presidents as well as Democratic presidents. And so likability is a huge factor. And it's one of those personal traits that we look for in somebody who is auditioning for Commander-in-Chief.
Donna Brazile, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank
we appreciate
you.
It. Donna Brazile, Democratic political strategist, campaign manager for Al Gore. Of course, our thanks as well to political junkie Ken Rudin. Appreciate it as always, Ken.
Thanks, Neil. I will not resign.
Up next, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's tough words for the African Union on Libya and Jacob Zuma's follow-up denouncement of NATO's mission there. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.